According to the mythic accounts, Hercules was God begotten, and to whose task there was scarcely an end. The whole idea that these mythic characters that we had shadowy images of could be expansions on the tale of the revelation of Christ is revolutionary, to say the least. I mean, I don't know anybody else that teaches that besides here. I don't know if that bothers you or not. I can show you ancient references to this. But it's dangerous to run around and talk about this, you know, just to like your old Baptist friends, because they'll automatically think you're a heretic. But we're not. All we're saying is that everything in the universe is a revelation of Christ, and the myths are a far more clear or precise revelation than was ever guessed of in the past. So I just want you to this isn't scripture, so it doesn't have the same weight as scripture. But to me, it expands the mystery and puts more flesh and personality on who Jesus Christ really is and what his finished work is and why we can rest, because he finished the labors. Okay?
When I first started, I guess 6 years ago, something like that, I thought it was really weird, but it caused me to realize that I in no way believed that Jesus Christ was before the foundation of the world. I mean, I just didn't believe that. I believed that this other stuff, you know, that there were cavemen, and then it grew up, and then there was this stuff, and then 2,000 years later, there was this guy Jesus. I just didn't believe that everything in the world was created by, for, through, and of Jesus Christ.
Okay, so in this mythic account, Hercules was, first, he was God begotten, and there was scarcely an end to his labors. I mean, that's the thing when you read the myths and the Herculean myth. I mean, there was always another labor, always another impossible task that he had to do. From his birth to his death, his mission only was to accomplish the most difficult and wonderful and wondrous feats. I'm going to review the 12 labors quickly here, and then we'll get into the details. He vanquished the great evil powers, such as the lion of Nemean, the lion which was begotten from Typhon, the mad bull of Crete, which no mortal dared look upon, the boar of Erymanthus, the brazen-footed and golden-horned stag, the vast filth of the Augean stables, the swarms of life-destroying Stymphalian birds, the flesh-eating mares of Diomedes, the queen of the devastating Amazons, the triple-headed Geryons and his devil dog, the dragon which guarded the apples of Hesperides, the many-headed Hydra sprung from the evil Typhon, and the three-headed snaky monster which kept the gates of hell, by which Hercules afterwards died.
Is that what he's holding?
Hmm?
Is that what he's holding in the picture?
No.
The three-headed snaky monster?
I don't know. I don't remember.
There's just a three-headed snaky-looking thing.
No, but those are the apples.
Okay, in the belly of the sea monster, he is said to have remained 3 days and three nights. By the Greeks' own confession, they did not understand who or what Heracles, who is the Greek version of Hercules, was, or what was meant by all his great labors. He was yet to them the sublimest of the hero gods. Now, go to Acts 11, I think. it's Acts 17, I'm sorry. Now, we're going to see a quote in Acts 17 in a minute from the poet Aratus. And he's the one who also sung the song of the constellations. You remember when I read that to you? And he, Aratus, said of Hercules, quote, an image none knows certainly to name, or what he labors for. And again, he describes him as the inexplicable image. And the great early Greek scientist Ptolemy referred to him in corresponding terms. They could not make out their greatest hero, or they could provide no meaning for all his works. He was called both the unknown God by their poets and the unknowable God. Paul in Acts speaks of this unknown God and he identifies him. So let's go to Acts 17, starting in verse 16. Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons, and in the market daily with them that met with him. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and the Stoics encountered him, and some said, what will this babbler say? And some, he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, which is Mars Hill.
That's where you were?
Huh?
Is that where you were?
Yeah. It's the Parthenon is up here, and it's in the highest hill in Athens, and it overlooks Athens. Remember, the word Parthenon, it means temple to the Virgin. And so that whole Parthenon temple and all its, I mean, it's one of the grandest things of the ancient world. It was a temple to Virgo and to who she would bring forth, the Coma, the virgin and her child. Now, Paul is just up, and when Paul was there, it was immaculate. It was, I mean, there's nothing in the modern world to compare with. I mean, even now in its ruins, it's absolutely breathtaking. You come off this pathway from the Parthenon and you go through a little park, then there's this big rock. You have to climb up the rock. And that's where the speakers in these daily discourses sat. And then the people that were interested sat in this park area right below them, right below this big rock. And so I'm sitting up there. And I just found out that what the Parthenon was, that it was a temple to the Virgin and to her son. And I became Paul. It was one of those who are you kind of things. I mean, it's just awesome. Anyway, so now we're there. And they took him and brought him unto Mars Hill, saying, may we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is. For thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We would know, therefore, what these things mean. For all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time in nothing else, but either to tell or to hear some new thing. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are too superstitious. But it doesn't say too superstitious. What it says in the Greek, and this is one of the words that the translators for King James, they just couldn't bear it to translate the right way. It says, what he says is, I perceive that in all things you are too religious. Now that, pretty heavy. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, and again, he uses the same word there that he would use for the people that were worshiping in a Christian church. And what he's saying is, I passed by and beheld your acts of worship, what they were worshiping, you know, what they were giving breath to, what they gave life to. As I passed by and beheld your worship, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God, whom therefore you ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you. Now, that unknown God, that inscription, it said, not unknown, to the unknowable God, and it was Hercules. Hercules. Can you hear me?
As you remembered something, back in 61 or 62, my wife and I went to Italy, and we were in the Roman Forum, and we had a guide, and as we were going through the Forum, we were near the thing called the Temple to the Vestal Virgins. I can't believe this. I have a photograph of this somewhere. Some little Italian waif, street urchin kind of a kid, ran up to the door as we were coming down. He ran up to the door and he left a glass of, I think it was sweet water or Coke or something like that, and a bundle of wildflowers and a note with a rock. And we walked up and we read. The guide read the note because it was in Italian, and I photographed it. I think I have a slide somewhere, but it said to the unknown God. The guide said it was an offering to the unknown God.
Yeah.
Wild in Rome.
Whom therefore you ignorantly worship. What he's saying is not you worship him because you give him breath, you're ignorant. He's saying that you don't give him enough breath. In other words, he's saying, you understand what he's saying? He's saying that you don't see the mystery. Now watch. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. He's looking at the Parthenon and all these temples to the gods around him. Neither is worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things, and hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and it determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. Now, what that means is, he's not condemning them for worshiping or giving breath or being interested in this Hercules. He's expanding their understanding so that they can see that each step along the process, that myth was necessary to reveal Christ. And he's saying to each one of you, and now and then, that you are born in a particular place and in a particular time, exactly as you should be, exactly where you should be, exactly when you should be, that you might fulfill the purposes of God if you can only abandon yourself to his will. So that everything in your life as of this moment is perfect.
You are a temple. Just like that.
Can you hear that? And it's determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. Now, in him we live and move and have our being, is a quote from the poet Aratus, speaking of Hercules. For as much then as we are the offspring of God, in the verb tense there, it says as much as we are the potential offspring of God. We are the sperm cells of God. We ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art or man's and man's devices. And the times of this ignorance God winked at, but now commandeth all men everywhere to repent, because he hath appointed a day in the which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, in that he hath raised him from the dead. And when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, and others said, we will hear thee again of this matter. So Paul departed from among them, howbeit certain men clave unto him, and believed, among the which was Dionysius and an Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. And after these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth. I mean, you understand I made this exact trip. He starts earlier. It goes in Philippi and Berea and Thessalonica and then Athens, then Corinth. I mean, that's what I followed that exact trip. Now, this is big stuff. This is real important. I mean, just...
Excuse me, but, you know, the thing he said to these people is really... I keep having this thought. This is where I, in a spot where I had to speak, this is what I would say to people that I see and hear on TV all the time, that to believe in is not big enough.
You trivialize God.
The little thing you're saying is just a little piece of it. You don't believe in a God that is all and in all. And I mean, you're the same thing.
Okay. Let's just get some common denominators of Hercules. First, well, what I'm saying is, let's compare Hercules and Christ. First, both of them were a virgin son. Both of them were predicted and depicted by the prophets. Both of them were a God-begotten man.
Virgin son, because he was the son of the god, right? Of
Virgo.
Zeus?
Huh?
He was the son of Zeus?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was a God-begotten man. He comes against a roaring satanic lion who goeth about seeking whom he may devour. The lion and both of them. He strikes the heads of the great serpent lurking in the bogs to ravage and destroy. He frees the world of all its monsters and hellish plagues and cleanses it of all its vast filth. He fights and slays the dragon. He recovers access to the fruit of the tree of life. Hercules, for the Greeks, that was the golden apples. He bears the weight of the whole guilty world on his shoulders. He descended into hell in the belly of the sea monster to rescue the princess. Before him, spirits cowered, and kings of perdition yielded. grasp the struggling three-headed dragon dog in charge of the gates of hell, and bore him off, leading captivity captive. He was wounded in the dreadful encounter in his heel unto death, yet living still. He was suffered from the poisoned garment of others' sin. He mounted the funeral pyre to die of his own accord amid the fires. And he ascended amid the clouds with his foot forever on the head of the serpent. This can't be an accident. There is no other person in myth, in any culture, around which such great and wondrous deeds crowd so thickly. To kill him and be rid of him has been the only goal of the dragon and his minions in every generation. The dragon and his brood of venomous powers of all trivialize him by myth, or they make him only chief among their other gods. Now, as we've seen in the last decon, Orpheus will not lose the crown. A scorpion may sting his heel, but his foot will still crush his head. Hercules may be brought to his knee, but he remains victorious forever in those pictures. Thou shalt tread upon the serpent and the adder, the young lion and the dragon, thou shalt trample underfoot, from the Psalms. Aristotle says, Metaphysics, chapter 10, verse 8, religion and philosophy had been lost, and that much had been added after the mythical style, while much had come down and, quote, may have been preserved to our times as the remains of the ancient wisdom. The ancient Aristotle said that. A man named Neander said, quote, the fragments of a tradition which transmitted the knowledge of divine things possessed in the, I mean, he said that of the stars, possessed in the earliest times. And that's what I believe. I believe with everything in me that at the beginning of the myths, they were pure stories. Pure prophetic stories that revealed the fullness of the Godhead in the stars. Slowly but surely, they were lost and then relegated to comic book characters or cartoons. Just as,
you know. Bad sci-fi, right?
Hmm?
Or bad sci-fi movies.
Well, I think I'll quit that. That's enough thinking. We start with specificity in the 12 labors of Hercules. Well, let me review real quickly the 12, because we'll go in. It's going to take us a long time to go through them one by one. But the first labor was the slaying of the Nemean lion. He skinned the lion by use of its own claw. And that's important, we'll see. And that pelt was worn as armor. And by that act, Hercules gained dominion over the seasons. And so what he did by the first act was he redeemed time.
That's a lion skin, isn't it?
Yeah. But the lion had to be skinned. It couldn't be skinned with any knife or any obsidian. It could only be skinned with its own claw, which is really neat when we get into it.
So the first thing that he does is
redeem time.
And he's not, so he's not subject.
Not subject to time.
Okay. We'll start with that one.
So I don't understand.
I'll defeat
time.
Lion
skin.
What
does
Satan on
have relevance to
redeem
time?
Think about it.
God. Because the roaring lion is the god of this world.
So he wraps the god of this world around him as his armor.
It's also the last
one. But that's the lion of the tribe of Judah.
It's the real lion.
The real lion.
So the first thing I'll do, I'll go out there and I'll
take control over time. Okay, the second labor was the slaying of the Hydra, the seven-headed Hydra. That only once, if you missed it. Tough.
By the tape.
Slaying of the seven-headed Hydra. Hydra.
Hydra.
H-Y-D-R-A.
H-Y-D-R-A, Hydra.
It's a one-celled organism now, but it's a
many-headed
monster.
This is a,
and you
got to
find the right head.
He's going to go into all this in depth. Yeah.
Okay. When one was crushed or killed, another grew. Sound
We've
familiar?
Seen that, haven't we? We've seen that. That was cool.
But only one of the seven was the immortal head. And he was constantly hiding somewhere else.
That was a great movie.
And you must
sacrifice
it
that.
That head must be severed with a particular, only one kind of a sword, and it must be buried forever under a particular unique rock. That's when you overcome the evil one. See, all these, and that's why I keep telling you, you're fighting the wrong battle. Every time one of those other battles that isn't the right one, it just grows a new head.
He gladly sacrificed.
And this is the seventh, the slaying of the Hydra. You can't possibly understand the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation without understanding that. Much of it, you can't understand any of Revelation without understanding this, in fact. You get these, as I said, you get these weird, you know, scorpions or helicopters. Okay, the capture of the stag of Arcadia. He had to pursue him without any rest for 365 days and nights. And the stag throughout ancient myth represented wisdom. And he had to capture the boar. Boar is universally the beast of death, or the beast of representing total self-seeking. So with the fourth labor, you stop serving death. This is Harry's favorite. And he had to clean the stables.
It was a Herculean task.
The interesting thing about it is, these huge, huge stables had to be cleansed in a particular, unique way. And they had to be cleansed in one day, completely. Or if any, the smallest drop of filth was left, before you blinked your eyes, it was all full of filth again. You had to alter the course of two rivers. And this represents the waters of purification. And the flesh-eating birds, the birds always represent demons, and the unclean birds. So the sixth victory was the victory over the spirit world, or the demon world. Then he had to capture the mad bull that fed on human flesh. They were in the age of Taurus, remember. So the mad bull represented the god of that age. If Hercules were now, he would have to what? He would have to do something with the Pisces. He had to catch all and clean all the fish in the ocean or something. the idea that you have to see, though, is this mad bull fed on human flesh. So the god of this, the age of Tarsus, it feeds on your flesh. And they had to capture the man-eating mares, four of them. Anybody want to guess what the four horses are?
One of them pale, one of them red, one of them.
That's the. In that part of that process, we had to struggle with Thanatos. Remember what Thanatos is? I don't remember that. Next, he had to steal the girdle of Hippolyte, who was the queen of the Amazons. The girdle had to be captured and given to the proper bride, so she would have the correct clothing for the marriage. And the girdle always represents, and that's why it says you know, girdle with truth in the Bible. I know they were speaking of this, because the girdle had to be the truth and righteousness, which is the only garment of the bride of Christ. This next one is the wild one. The tenth labor is, he had to seize the cattle of Geryon. They must be seized without payment or demand. And Geryon was the guardian of the alphabet. So the tenth labor is victory over names. And he had to bring back the golden apples. He had to battle the dragon and the giant bandit Antaeus to bring back the apples. In other words, his 11th victory was the victory over the fruit of the tree of good and evil. In the 12th and final labor, he had to fetch Cerberus. Now, this is where you get into the Lycian mysteries. And this is the 12th of the last labor, is leading captivity captive, but this is my favorite labor, because we get to go into the ancient mysteries. And it shows how that it's the final act of having dominion over all things, even that which appears to be mysterious, or the mysteries. So that's a thumbnail sketch of what we'll be studying for the next few weeks. Matt? Anybody have any response or any thoughts?
I was just, I don't know what the thought is, but it's something about, you've got these pictures, these Herculean, heroic pictures of what he did. And then here you've got what it looks like he did in the flesh, which was he walked and he talked and he loved his brother and he laid down his life.
Yeah, this is.
It's like, you know, I don't know what it is I'm trying to say, but on the one hand, it's this huge heroic, in the truest sense of the word, written in the stars. But here, it was a little kid, a little Jewish kid.
It's a little Jewish kid from Galilee.
Yeah, I mean, who you know, there was a time nobody was looking.
Except those with eyes to see and ears to hear, and then they, even at his birth, they went halfway across the known world.
Yeah, there's really a picture there for us. It's,
part of the definition, though, of him, remember, was constantly humility.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. But the idea that there was a cloud of witnesses, I don't know.
The heavens declare the glory. Read that. Somebody read Psalm 19 real quick. The first few verses.
The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race.
It's talking in the circuit of the heavens and the constellations. It's the bridegroom coming forth out of his chamber.
This is the last verse about this. He's going forth is from the end of the heaven. His circuit unto the ends of it. There's nothing hid.
I think part of what I'm trying to say is that he allowed himself to be bound. He allowed himself to come into time and space and let this story be told in the life of one pathetic little, just one little human being, one little Jewish human being in a dusty, dirty little country is the way it would look to him. You know, and a failed life at that.
Well, what I would ask you is please, please, please don't take this stuff lightly.
Something hit me when you were talking about the 12th one and the dominion and how seeing that you own all things, and the only way you can see that is if you know that Christ, it's all about him. And for a brief moment it's like something I felt pierced me and said, yeah, you are worthy, you are, but not because of me, because of your life, because you're saying.
Along with that, nothing important. Jeez, what stacks up to that?
The promise of God is if you seek Him first in these areas, in His rightness, then every needful thing will come unto you. No sweat.